Are those of you that are here ready to answer some questions? Did you prepare for that, or are you just like, what are we going to do tonight?
Preach it, Rabbi.
What are we going to do tonight? That's where I'm at tonight.
Okay, then let's go to page.
I love you.
I'll talk to you after class.
I'll have an answer by then.
You know what inspired me? You know that part where you were talking about.
Yeah.
Okay, we're gonna do it like this tonight. There's some things I want to try to work out. Everybody knows, of course, we're in the process of counting the Omer, and counting the Omer is counting the days that we have between Pesach and Shavuot or Pentecost. Go to page 103. There's one right here you can have.
Do you have another one up there?
No, ma'am.
I'll see.
Elizabeth? No, that one was Elizabeth. On page 103, it would have been day 7 on counting or the Omer. Now, I'm not going to get super entailed in this, but if you're using the Sephardi Arot Siddur, well, you can be using just about any Siddur. I'm sorry. What you'll find when you get to the place where it in your Siddur, where it's talking about counting the Omer, you can just go to that page, counting the Omer. And you're going to see what happens in counting the Omer is that the prayer Anabakoach is taken Kabbalistically and broken down so that when it's broken down, it matches the different attributes of the lower seven spherot. And so it starts in the first week, the first day, Chesed v'Chesed. Okay, so God's loving kindness or God's loving mercy with God's loving mercy. You know, every day in the first week we'll have Chesed as the principal character, modifying the other six characteristics that go with it. Now, I know that's very vague, but short of spending about a week and a half on it or much more time than that, you will understand that there are 48 characteristics that are being available for us to develop ourselves spiritually over these period of 48, 49 days, 50 days. We don't count the 50th, and we experience the great joy of Pesach. So this is the primary counting of all that. So on page 103, you have the Maseret, which is the first principle or the first person of Chesed. Now, His Eminence, when His Eminence told me that he thought that Ephesians belonged to counting the Omer. And so I set out to understand if it did, in fact, work with counting the Omer. And not so much my surprise, but much to my surprise, guess what? It falls out into 49 readings just perfectly. So then what I did was, because I had looked at the way, and Adon Suriel and Gered Gibor may remember some time ago, that the way that we started to count the Omer was we understood that there was these seven characteristics which matched the seven lower sefirot. And so we talked about each one of the characteristics, and we actually, in the past, what we did was we each week we could see that characteristic and we gave a particular meditation or a particular exercise to do. So if you had a chesed with chesed, that meant you need to do what? You need to find somebody and show them chesed. And then if you have chesed with deen, which is the next connection that you would make, that would mean you can show someone chesed, but you also have to do what? You have to show some restriction, some restraint, or show them that there are boundaries to things, etc. So it works itself back and forth like this all the way through the 49 days. But what I did was I took the seven men of the Snoga and I broke it down with the seven men of the Snoga into the same idea that was being propagated and is in nearly every Siddur that you read. And so when I did this, his eminence is like, well, how did you come up with this? And I said, it's right here in the Siddur. I just transposed it from Chesed to the Masoret, etc., etc. So this is how this piece of Ephesians has been cultivating, and how it came to be, and how come it's broken down into these particular places. Now it's really beautiful, because what happens is each night as you're counting the Omer, you can look at Ephesians and you can see the particular attribute or characteristic that you should be trying to develop in yourself for that particular day. And obviously understanding that you're counting at night, so you're beginning your day with understanding that particular Mida, or however you want to say that. Everybody with me? Everybody lost? Nobody lost? Everybody's okay. Okay, 103, the piece on Ephesians, day 7. So the eyes of our understanding, being enlightened that you may see. This is the idea of da'at. But it's not just see, it's the idea of having a perfect consciousness of something. You see, what is the confidence of his, Messiah's, mission, and what is the wealth of our splendor of his inheritance in the union with the tzaddikim? This is the saints, or the ones who have, we would say, righteousness, or righteous, generous, as eminence does all the time, because those who are considered to be righteous are also supposed to be full of generosity. You know, when you go to a place and a person truly has chesed, they say, you want a drink of water? You want a bottle of water? You want a soda? You want a, you know, and they're not standing there staring at you like, when are you going to leave, you know? You ever been in those places? And what is the excellent magnitude of his, God's power, working in us, the faithfully obedient, who operate according to his majestic strength and his cosmic power? This power he, God, worked in Messiah by raising him from the dead And he seated him at the right hand in the heavenlies, far above principalities, chokmah, and authorities, bina, and power, da'at, and dominion, gedolah, and every authority being named, not only in this present age, but also in the world that is ever coming. And he, God, has subjected all things under his, Messiah's, authority, and give him to be the head over all things to the Asnoga. This is not just the local Asnoga. This is to the synagogue by and large. And here I'm actually talking on a cosmic level, not on a local level, and not even on a global level. I'm talking about something above that, which is his body and the fullness of him who fulfills all with the presence, power, agency, and riches of God. Now, I have, as I have explained in the past to you, that one of the things you should do is buy a big notebook, and that every week you should take and put your Torah Seder in that notebook and keep it for a handy reference. I've done the same thing here with just the Nazarene Codicil. Just the Nazarene Codicil fits, just the commentary to the Nazarene Codicil fits in one volume, about four-inch notebook. So if you did that, then you'd have all of the Nazarene Codicil, and you could just turn to chapter and verse with no problem.
We haven't even hit 1 week, and I'm in book number two. I mean 1 year, sorry. Yeah. And I'm already, because I see them.
Yeah, very good. Okay. So what I want to do now is, keeping in mind what we just read, everybody still have that in, still in their mind. It talks about what Hashem, God, does through Meshua. Meshuach. We'll say that. I think I need some vodka in here or something.
Some cocoa juice?
Yeah. Some of that stuff Aron Eleazar makes. It wakes me up in a hurry. Now, I'm reading from Mark 4:35 and 41, but I'm reading my translation. And what I want you to be able to do here is I want to play connect the dots, okay? So everybody got their thinking cap on this evening? Verse 35, on that day when evening had come, he led across to the other side, and leaving the congregation and the other boats that were with him, and they took him with them in the boat just as he was. And suddenly a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking over into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a cushion. And they woke him up and said to him, Rabbi, don't you care that we're about to die? And he woke up and commanded the storm to desist, saying to the sea, Peace be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said to them, Why are you so timid, or why are you so afraid? How is it that you have no faithfulness, or you're not faithful in your ability to resolve this issue? That's my little expanded translation there. Said in the great, and they were filled, or they had a great sense of awe of Hashem, of God, and it came upon them, and they said to one another, Who then is this that even the wind and the sea faithfully obey and hear him? Mark 5:1. So then they came to the other side of the sea, to the region of the Gerasenes. And when Yeshua had stepped out of the boat, immediately a man met him from out of the tombs, and he had an unclean shaddai, a demon. And he lived among the tombs, so that no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been bound with shackles and chains. But he would break the chains apart, and he broke the shackles into pieces. Now, this guy will probably give Louis Frigno a run for his money. So if this guy's breaking iron chains and et cetera, you know that there's something literally beyond the natural power here with this individual. Yeah, because he's got powers to, you know, I'm sure, you know, men of strength and whatever can, you know, if you give them a dog chain, sure, they can break it. We had a dog when I was a kid. His name was Glenn. And the dog was tied inside, his chain was tied inside of a oil drum, a 250-gallon oil drum cut in half, and it had a T-post inside with the chain tied to that. The dog would get inside of the doghouse, which is about, you know, about two-thirds of that table, and then he would come out of the doghouse flying. Fast as he could run. He was part basset and part beagle and something like that.
Yeah.
He had run to the end of the chain and then hit the chain full throttle. Then he turned around and did it again. And one day he finally broke the chain and we didn't see him again. That's a dog we're repeatedly trying to do this. This guy, I don't know.
Maybe he just wore that end piece of link out so much that it finally...
That's what happened. That's exactly what happened. So he breaks his shackles into pieces, and no one had strength to control him, making him behave in a normal human way. He lived night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, and he was always crying and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Yeshua from a distance, he ran and fell down before him and crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Yeshua, Son of the Most High God?" He said, "I implore you, by God, do not torment me." For he said, saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean Shaddai, you demon." And Yeshua asked him, he said, "What is your name?" And he replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send him out of the country. Now a big herd of swine or pigs was feeding there on the hillside. And they begged as him saying, "Send us in to the pigs and let us enter them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean Shadim came out and were entered into the pigs, and they heard the herds numbering about 2,000 rushing down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. Now, I'm going to ask the question. What does all that have to do with Passover?
An individual deliverance.
Individual deliverance.
It's like the nation was delivered out of Egypt.
Okay.
So he was delivered out of his shackles.
Okay. Now, I read you two pieces of Mark, right? That was one instance. That was one instance. In the first instance, what did we read about in the first instance? Storm. Now, taking those two pieces of material plus what we read out of Ephesians, dots A, B, and C, do we have a giraffe or what do we have? When we start in the Haggadah, we come to a place that is called Magid. Magid basically means the tell. Okay? And so the Magid is talking about the telling of the story of the deliverance of the Bnei Israel from Mitzrayim or from Egypt. And it starts off with various things. It starts off with Halach Ma'anya, which is, it talks about the bread and the bread of poverty. And then we come to a part called Manishnata. And this is where the questions are asked by the children. And then there's a small discussion about the different children. And then as you move forward a little bit, you begin to discuss the idea of what happened and how it came about that the B'nai Yisrael went down to Egypt. They went down to Egypt as a minority, and they came back as a nation. A nation delivered out by the hands of God. And the Haggadah goes through the story, talking about we were few and then we were numerous. And of course, when they got numerous, or when they became a nation or a large number of people, then Pharaoh, who hadn't been treating them really so well, decides that, you know what, we're going to go a little bit farther here because we're afraid that they might join our enemies, and then we really would be in bad time. We would be destroyed, etc. So Hashem, in the entire process, knows exactly what he's going to do. And so he begins to, it says in Exodus 9, with a mighty hand, and it talks about the pestilence as it is written, and it starts to talk about the different ideas of pestilence and etc. Now, a couple of weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, we talked about the Shaddai, the Shaddim. And we found out that the Shaddim were what? Gibberet Sheva looked up the magic word on her iPad, and she came up with an answer. You don't remember? You're supposed to remember these things. They're very important. Shaddim, Shaddai, is a foreign god. Okay? So you have foreign god, Shaddim. A Shaddai is one. Shaddim is more than one. So we were talking about the foreign gods, and we could see what was Yeshua's interaction with these, quote, foreign gods in these two particular cases. Now, I just picked two, not necessarily fully at random, but at random, so that we could discuss this. Now, what you see, how this connects to Pesach, is how God goes about delivering his people from Mitzrayim. And I'm just going to go through this list rather quickly, but it's well worth noting and writing down. Now, 20-some years ago, Dr. Elisheva and I started doing Seder'im, and we've done, for about the last 20 years, we've done at least two. And on occasions, we've done the two and then did demonstrations of the Pesach Seder for other people at different times. Now, so when I come to the place that I like to talk about the plagues, I like to show what Hashem has done by addressing the God of the Egyptians that is being addressed. Okay? So, for example, the first plague, you guys all have them memorized in order, right? The first one is Dam, blood. And what did the what was the significance of the blood? Where was the blood?
It's in the water. Right. In the life.
Interesting, I've heard through some exegete that some Jewish interpretations that said if took a glass of water, let's say I'm the Jewish person taking a glass of water, and I take a drink of the water, and it's water, and an Egyptian knows that this is water, and he's been down to the Nile, which is nothing but blood, and he says, the Jew has a glass of water, I could take a drink of water, hand him the glass, when he takes, pours the water up to his mouth, it's blood. So Hashem, of course, we say he works a miracle for the B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel, but he is definitely going to exact vengeance on Egyptians and their gods. The first god was not actually the blood, but what was affected by the blood, and that was the Nile River. The Nile River was the goddess and the god of life, basically, for the Jewish people. What was the next?
Egyptian.
Thank you. Egyptian people. What was the next plague?
It was
the frogs. Huh? Frogs. Frogs. Sephardiah. Frogs. Frogs. You got frog protection? Have you seen that commercial? Oh, man. Fraud protection? Are you saying fraud protection or frog protection? I think we're on the same page, he says. You got to see it. Heka is the god. Heka. And she's the goddess of intelligence, and she was represented by a frog. Interesting. God gave them so many frogs that said that they piled up in piles. And if you read in the Holy King James tongue, it said they stank. Then the next one was lice. This is the one thing that the Egyptian magicians could not produce was lice. And so it covered all the people and all their animals. Then the beasts, this is the god Set, who represented by a crocodile, had been in the temples of the priests, and so God sent them wild beasts. Plagues, their god was Apis, a bull. And they worshipped Orisus, a goat, and Isis, a cow. And God killed the cattle with one plague. Boils, here's your boils. Gave them boils, and even their magicians had them showing that they, the magicians, were powerless over this particular plague. Hail, the horse, the falcon god, was defeated as God destroyed their crops with great hail mixed with fire. And the locusts ravaged everything that the hail had left. They were winged creatures. Then there was the plague of darkness. Which god would you say that this affected? Ra. Ra.
Is
what?
Darkness?
Huh?
Ra is darkness?
Ra is sun.
Right. So the opposite. Got it. I understand.
Okay, so, you know, if he's such a powerful god, you know, then where's the light, you know? Okay, and of course the final is the death of the firstborn. Now, I did that because I'm trying to take you down the primrose path. And now I want to go to page 129 in your two. 1 through 3, Ephesians, day 8 of the Omer, which would have been the Chazan and the Masoret. And it says here, and you Gentiles were dead in your trespasses and sin, in which you once walked, according to the course of this worldly system, according to the rulers of the powers of the air, the spirit that now works in the sons of disobedience, And we have all behaved according to the passion of our own Yetzirah, following the desires of the body and thoughts, and were by nature the children of wrath like everyone else. So now I hope that what you can do with that particular set of verses, go back to Mark chapter 4, and just we'll recap here, where that there is this storm that is raging, and his Talmudim, Yeshua's disciples, seemed not to be able to deal with this particular situation. And so they seem to be most petrified, to the point of waking up the rabbi from his nap and saying, "Aren't you afraid? Aren't you concerned about us? We're about to all die." And what does Yeshua do? See if you can connect these two dots right here. "And you Gentiles were dead in trespasses and sins in which you once walked, according to the course of this worldly system, according to the ruler of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the sons of disobedience." Is there any connection here? Now, Yeshua's ministry, I'm going to say it this way, Yeshua's ministry specifically, yes, as Messiah. And so this shows one facet of Messiah's ministry. Okay, you understand what I'm saying? Because there are many, many facets of Messiah's ministry that can be taking place all at the same time. But we're concentrating on Yeshua and his role as Messiah and seeing what he did. Now, you know, all of you know, we could go back and set the stage, but we know that he's in the Galilee. Okay? He lives in the Galilee. The second passage we read from Mark chapter 5 tells us that he is in the region of the Galilee. The Gerasenes is on the east side, on the what's the name of that place on that side?
Decapolis, Gerasenes.
No, Bashan. It's the
Engedi.
No. Engedi's down at Dead Sea. Anyway, we can see that he's working in that area, and you should see something from Yeshua's ministry. And the reason I related it to the Ephesians is for you to be able to get the grasp that it's on a grand scale. It's not just on a local scale. Even though he's dealing with things in this particular local arena, if you will, he's battling things on a cosmic level. It is not just like, you know, the Crips and the Bloods are in town and who's going to fight who and who's the police force that's going to get rid of the two rivalry gangs, etc. This is not the issue at hand. Yeshua is working on something here in the Galilee, and he's working on a global arena, not just a local arena. But he starts out in a local arena in the Galilee. Now, I say this like this, and you've heard me say it before, so you'll hear me say it again, but you need to keep these things in mind, because there are people who say things, I'll talk about this in a minute, people who say things about these events and they twist them in another way so that it would appear that the message of the Torah, or the message of the Masorah, of the Hakam Sefet, Hakam Shavuot, etc., that it is it is of no value. And we'll get to that in a minute. But what I want you to grasp is that here Yeshua is doing something. And then if we connect the dot just a little bit further down the line, what you have is a place of peace and rest for the rabbis, who are the ones who initiate the writing down or the redaction of the Mishnah. And they do it in this particular vicinity. They do it in the Galilee. But I contend that they would not have been able to do this had Yeshua not had the ministry in the Galilee. Okay, why? Because instead of being able to write down or take the notes from the papers and the things that they gathered together to construct the orator, the Mishnah, they're going to be doing the same thing that Yeshua did. They've got to go out and fight the prince of the power of the air, etc., in that vicinity, and you know, argue and contend with that. And so half of the day or more of the day is going to be involved in having to fight these Shadim. But Yeshua handles it before they ever get there. Yeshua prepares the arena, as it were, so that there could be a serene spirit for them to work in the Galilee and produce what we have as the oral Torah. Everybody with me?
Mm-hmm. Clears the way.
He absolutely clears the way. He's the pioneer. The Golan Heights, by the way, is the name that I was looking for. This is where the feeding of the pigs is a more to the south, but nevertheless where it went. Now let's see if we can glean a couple things from this, and then I'm going to talk about some academic papers. Okay? So the first case in Mark 4:35, you see that this power that he's dealing with here is not just some wimpy little whatever. He's got enough power to be rocking the boat, and his intention is, the spirit that's behind all this has an intent. What is it?
Destroy
him. Yeah, he's isolating this boat. You think he knows who's in that boat? Well, if those spirits can come running up to Yeshua and say, "We know who you are. You're the Son of the Most High." You think this wind and this spirit that's behind that would understand who he is? Mm-hmm. But isn't it interesting that the wind didn't make him wake up? He was not intimidated by that spirit, so much so that...
Well, there's a limited thing that they can do.
Yeah, but
they only have so many powers or so much.
Absolutely, absolutely. But Yeshua is showing his contempt for this being by... I'm going to take me a nap. I'm so worried about this, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
Now, see, we'll go to Mark...
But it goes to a lot to say about his preparation and where he was spiritually to deal with that. Unless you're doing the proper spiritual preparation and so forth.
You better watch what you're doing.
Yeah, you're slapping at a hornet's nest and you're going to get stung.
Even Shadim have restrictions, don't they?
Sure. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Okay, but now watch this. They came, Mark 5:1. They came to the other side of the sea, to the region of the Gerasenes. This is in the Golan Heights, about the southern end down here. And when Yeshua had stepped out of the boat, immediately a man met him from out of the tombs with an unclean Shadim. Now, what do we say the Shadim are?
Foreign
gods. What? Let's say it again, because what I want you to get I want you to get something here that perhaps you're reading what we're saying, but you need to go the next step. Now let's say it again. A Shaddai is a
foreign
to where?
To Israel.
To Eretz Israel. Okay? So this spirit, these spirits that we've been talking about, are in Eretz Israel. And they're foreign gods. So then the question is, how'd they get there?
How do they gain legitimacy?
How do they gain legitimacy in this region?
I had an idea, but I don't know how to word it right or word it. If there's no spirituality or God in your life, then it opens up.
Sure, it opens up
for these foreign gods to come through, or it's not really what I want to say, but
yeah,
there's a weakness.
You're giving them a permission because
right.
You're not, etc.
Yeah.
But that doesn't say where they came from and how they got there.
Is there a realm that they come from?
There's a realm that they come from, absolutely. And if they are here, Yeshua is contending with them, but we would say if they're foreign gods, they should not have any right to operate in this region.
Would God allow them to come in?
Definitely. He, in a respect, we have to say it like this. He has to.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a reason why he has to. Foreign gods. So in other words, there means that the gods came from some foreign country, etc. And then really it's not too complex to just stop and think for a second. Wait a minute, they're under the subjugation of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that these Roman Gentiles, etc. brought any of their friends with them?
I would think so.
And the Greeks before them did.
Precisely. Okay? So you see, Shadim are these foreign gods. They're not the intermediaries or the powers that belong ruling and governing in Eretz Israel. We know who should be there. Michael should be there.
Mm-hmm.
Gabriel should be there. Raphael, we know the ones that belong there. These are foreign gods that he's working on.
They inherit
over. Yeah. So everybody with me now? So they're foreign gods. So if we go back to 4, and I didn't spend any time doing this. It took me, I don't know, 7-8 minutes, 9 minutes, 10 minutes to prepare the class tonight. If you went back and you studied and said that such and such was the god of the sea and etc., right? Poseidon or whoever is the god. Then, you know, he's in foreign territory and he's trying to intimidate Yeshua. And Yeshua's saying, hey, blow a little harder, son. You know, it's okay. I'm not afraid yet. And then you can see the amount of authority that Yeshua is imposing and exercising here, because he says, shut up. And, you know, I don't think he had to. I don't think he had to wake up and pray for a couple hours and then say, yeah, I think I'm ready now. Well, test and see if he'll shut up or not.
I think he was already prepared for it.
His person, basically, we could say it like this. This is my idea. I heard about this one gentleman that they asked him if he was ready. He says, I stays ready to keep from getting ready. So, yes. I think Yeshua was absolutely ready. I think he was absolutely prepared for this ministry that he was to function in. Everybody understand where we're at so far? Mm-hmm. Now let's make the game exciting. You will forgive me, but in our world, the way things work, I'm talking now about basically like the literary world and the world of academia. Let's see how I can say this to make you understand. You have people, scholars, that are on academic lists that their particular forte is whatever. You know, in academia, you could have a guy that his specialty is, you know, the atmosphere. He studies and follows all these models of the atmosphere, and then he basically, from the models that they have, they do what? They predict the weather. They tell us what we're going to expect. And so this person is, you know, he spent years of his life studying weather and things of that nature. Now, you and I would look to this individual and hope that he could give a reasonable weather forecast and be able to tell us, you know, is it going to be hot tomorrow? Is it going to be rainy? Is it whatever? What are the odds? What are the chances? The same basic idea functions with regards to, and I'm just going to say it like this, so I'm making it very, very broad, but to religious materials, okay? But just because an academic has a background in, let's just say, New Testament studies, does not mean, number one, that they are Christian, number two, that they're Jewish, or number three, that they're whatever, okay? So, the four gods, I told you, see. So you can take academics, and it works sometimes in a bit of a trickle down system. Okay. Now, a lot of people that are in the classes, etc., might not be interested in Googling up, you know, who the latest scholars are, academics are on Hakam Shaul, on Paul. That may not be an interest, but then somebody might say, you know what, I want to know Hakam Shaul a little bit better, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to Google Hakam Shaul. You'll have to do Paul, because if you view Hakam Shaul, you'll just be redirected right back down to our stuff. Might be a few out there just saying something a little bit different. But nonetheless, that will be what it is. Now, I say that because if you decide to fish on the internet, there's no telling what you're going to catch. Now, there are scholars who have put years and years in their life trying to understand Hakam Shaul. I'm speaking now more directly about what I want to get to. one of the leading scholars deals with the material that I just dealt with, but in a very, very different way, in a very, very negative way. Okay? So I laid out the material basically the way I wanted you to receive it, because I wanted you to think in certain parameters. I wanted you to think about what is happening in Yeshua's life and what's happening, which will happen later in Hakam Shaul's life. Now, just stop and think for a minute. If Yeshua prepares the Galilee, it ends up to the place that he's not just preparing the Galilee. This thing is spreading all over the world just like wildfire. And Hakam Shaul is one of the primary agents that is going out into the diaspora in trying to continue or further this ministry and bring this ministry to the place that it is cosmic. Okay? Now, there are scholars, and I'm going to just take one tonight. We may try to deal with others in the coming weeks. There is a scholar. Her name is Paula Fredrickson. I'm not afraid for you to know who she is. She is very, very academic. She was the chair at the Boston University, and now she's in university in Jerusalem. So she's not somebody to be just toyed with. She's done her homework in everything that she's done. She's done over 25 years of study just on Paul's life. And I'll say it like this, and you please forgive me, because I don't intend to sound... Anyway, I don't intend to sound. I don't care. I am not intimidated on how much she thinks she knows. Because she doesn't understand some very simple things. And she's built what we call model. Okay? Every academician will build his model. I have a model of Hakam Shaul. I have a model of this individual who I say, this is what he did, this is what he looked like, this is what he said, etc. And you put him in any circumstance, and then you can apply your model to that character. Is everybody with me? So you understand that, you know, I know he won't eat pork, I know he won't, etc., etc., right? And so you can put him into that model and then put him in a scene or a story, and then say, how is this man going to react in this particular environment? And your model of how you see Hakam Shaul is going to be, well, if they got pork on the table, he's not going to eat it. Blah, 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 blah. Okay? So now, number one. Ms. Fredrickson says that every Gentile... She leaves no room for any other person. A Gentile is someone who's not Jewish. Okay? So the Gentile, she says, there's no such thing as just the Gentile. All of them are pagans. All of them. All of them are pagans. Every one of them.
How can she know that many people?
Good question. And see, this is her model that she's trying to do. Say, so if you're a Gentile, you have to fit into this particular model.
So this is her model of Shaul's thinking.
The whole world that he has to deal in. Okay? So in other words, any Gentile that he comes in conflict with, or he comes into contact with, excuse me, is going to be a pagan. This pagan is going to be worshiping whatever gods that... This gets much more complex. I'm going to be very, very simple. But whatever gods that individual's family followed or worshiped, this person will do the same thing.
That's not true.
Okay? No, it's not. And see, that's the problem. See, when you make these ironclad walls that can't be bended or flexed or come to explain something outside of what your little model works out, right? Okay, number two. There was no such thing in the first century as a monotheist.
I'm not sure what that means. I think I have an idea.
One God.
Okay. What?
What's wrong with that statement?
It's wrong.
More than anything else, it's just wrong.
Didn't take me 25 years to figure that out either.
Figured out pretty fast, didn't you? Look at now. She says, hey, let's put Philo. We know Philo. He is in Egypt, and he is a Jewish exegete, a scholar. Her model would put this Jewish man, who is supposed to be a monotheist, in an arena with where Gentiles surround him, and then say, he cannot be a monotheist. He has to believe also in all these other gods that these other people worship. So we can shake our head and say, no, I know that's a line of whatever. Or we can stop and we can scrutinize what is being said and have a defense. So in other words, if she's going to say, and you're going to be in a debate with this woman, you would have to say, you know, how am I going to answer those issues sufficiently to refute what she has to say? So, take the first issue, that all Gentiles are pagan. You can say that has a truth, and that by and large they very well could have been, quote, pagan, or at least fit into those schools of thought. But it's interesting because in reading Paul, what does he do? He tells you, he says, you have to get rid of all these foreign gods. You can't eat anything that has been what? Sacrificed to a foreign god, etc., etc., etc. He goes down this list of the things that he can and cannot do. Okay? So that means if the Jew and the Gentile have any kind of interaction, that the Jewish person has to do what? He has to defend himself and prepare himself in such a way that he doesn't serve their gods, he doesn't venerate their gods, etc., etc. He doesn't eat the wrong things. And so we're playing an Orthodox Jewish model. Okay? So we're saying that the Jews of the first century, they have an orthodoxy to them, very much like today. And you cannot tell me, or you cannot say, that this monotheist, a Jewish person who believes in the one God of Israel, that he's not a monotheist. You can say that he's not. And what she's trying to purport is that, well, because he works in this particular office, he works in a Roman office, and all the people in the office worship these other gods. And they have to go to these particular festivals, etc., that venerate these gods, etc. So how do we deal with the monotheistic question of the fact that what she's trying to say is that they're all, not, there's no such thing as a monotheist in the first century? What I have to say is this, she's greatly confused.
Did she live in the first century?
Absolutely. But how are we going to refute this? And they came to the other side of the sea, to the region of the Gerasenes. And when Yeshua stepped out of the boat, immediately a man met him from the tombs, which had a shadid. What you have to realize and what you have to read in Chacham Shaul's writings, that we did this just a minute ago. What page are we on? 129? Where did my 129 go? Here it is right here. And you Gentiles, this addresses both situations. You were dead in your trespasses, in which you once walked according to the course of this worldly system, according to the rulers, the power of the air, the spirit, and now works in the sons of darkness. He answered the question right there. He acknowledges and understands that the pagans, the Gentiles, did exactly what she's saying. They did this. But he's telling them here that that's how you were, and it's not acceptable in this particular type of conduct. But look at how he addresses and acknowledges these, quote, gods. Is he a polytheist because he says, yeah, you worship the powers, the principalities, etc. He's not a polytheist, but he knows that there are other gods.
The Torah even says it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's not an issue if we understand the fact that the Jew says, well, I know that there's a god called Poseidon. And he's over all of the ocean.
Yeah, we're aware of it.
And yeah, we're perfectly aware of it. But there's one condition that you have to realize. And that is, all of those gods are subject to God.
Yeah.
And so we don't care if they believe. If we're not trying to evangelize them or make proselytes out of them, we know that they believe in all these things. And so what? But if they're turning toward God, which is this is what it says in Acts, right? So these that are turning to God, then we have to tell them these particular things. So to say that a Jew is a polytheist because he knows that there's a God called Ra, this is the sun god, whatever you name him, every civilization had a name for him, right? Okay, the same thing for darkness, the same thing for whatever. So you can jump up and down and say everyone in the first century was a polytheist. No, it doesn't work that way because the Jews understand that all of these, quote, gods are subordinate to.
So I'm wondering if she's included herself in that.
My question was, you know, the way she talks, you have to hear the lectures. You can listen to the lectures. I don't care if you listen to them. If I didn't want you to listen to them, I would have said, you know, some whatever. But it's interesting because the way she discusses these things, very intelligent woman, very, very intelligent, has a very intelligent argument. You hear one, you only need to listen to one lecture. I mean, you can listen to all you want, but you only need to listen to one because it's repetitive. She says the same thing every time, every lecture, no matter where she's at.
So out of 25 years, she hasn't removed herself out of the box.
So why is she important or to deal with?
Why is she important? It's because she's one of the major academics on Chacham Shaul and the New Testament.
And so that's.
So if you're going to have an answer, if you're going to have to do this type of work and propagate this type of message, you have to be armed with the information on how to refute these arguments. Otherwise, if you were, quote, set in a debate with someone like this, you'd be taken totally off guard. Let's say that someone read her material, followed her material, etc., and was well versed in everything she said. What are you going to do to answer these questions on an academic level to refute what she has to say?
What we just said. Everything is subject to God.
Precisely. And the Jews know it. Mm-hmm. And just because they know it doesn't mean they venerate it.
Right.
She wants you to believe that what they would do is they would go to the sacrifices, they would go to the games, etc. And I'm sure that some of that did transpire. But that does not mean that this person, because he went to the games or he watched the Super Bowl, was, you know, thinking that, yeah, that God is really the God that I really love and whatever. So I watched the game, so what, etc. Now, I'm going to do this. I've quit. I am very close to my limit.
So what you're really doing is doing the same thing Yeshua is doing, is battling that philosophy that's empowered by a false god.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, there's a bunch of them. Dr. Elisheva and I had just been married. And we used to walk up. We lived over off of Powell Street here. And we would walk up to the square, walk around the square and go pray for the city of Paris. And we hadn't been married just a few weeks. And I began to pull back the curtain. And she stops. She's in there, she can hear. She stops right dead in her tracks. And it's like, oy vey. Do you know how many devils we gotta fight? Yes, dear, I do. Are you still up for the game? I'm gonna give you just a couple of things here. I'm gonna close. I'm not gonna carry on.
Oy vey.
Did you stop and say oy vey? Well, not necessarily oy vey, but
I said that the other day. Oy vey.
When the Nazarenes were inside of these circles where that they had interaction with Gentiles who whether they did or did not, but let's just say here that they did have these foreign deities. They offered something. This is why I believe that there was a true explosion among Gentiles to turn to Judaism, to turn to Yeshua. They offered something that the Gentile, once he sees the truth, it's kind of like knocking the air out of this individual, knocking him to the place that he's like just in stark terror for what he sees and what he understands. And then obviously, if you present something to a person and you show that person error in their belief system to the place of shocking them, immediately they will be offset by fear. Like, if that is true,
then
exactly.
Yeah.
So here is one thing that transpired among them, well worth writing down, and that is that what the Jewish people were capable of doing, what the Nazarenes were capable of doing, was a transformation of cultural symbols. Okay? So you believe in Hermes. Who is Hermes? The transformation of cultural symbols. Who is Hermes?
He was the messenger who had winged feet.
Okay? So you believe in him. Okay? Now the Jew would say, you call him Hermes. but we say, etc. Okay? So the Jews could take each one of the gods that are venerated by these so-called pagans, and they could show the Gentiles the intermediary or the station of that particular god. Okay? And then when they would show that, oh, here's Hermes, here's Aphrodite, here's etc., go down the list of all the ones there, show their station, show who they are, and then show that they are all subordinate to God, then it's like stark terror in the Gentile's mind, because he realizes that no matter how much he's venerated these gods, what he has been involved in is idolatry. Okay? Because the idolatry is not to take some wooden carving and say, that's my God. Idolatry is to say that, you know, I know that you're the God of rain, but instead of asking God for rain, I'm going to go directly to the, quote, God of rain and ask him for rain. What's wrong with that? It's idolatry. You don't go to the intermediaries. You don't go to the subordinate powers. You go to God. And see, this is how the Jews understand how to live their life. So you say that, you know, we have to venerate the God of rain. We have to do this. We have to do that. Blah, blah, blah. And the Jewish person knows, I don't care what you say about this individual. You don't go to the intermediary God or the subordinate God. So Judaism could do a transformation of the characters, the symbols, and look at them and say, this is God and this is how God works. And they would come to the place that they would understand Deuteronomy 6:4 that there's only one God. And I believe that if there was anything else on the lips of the Nazarenes, that if you put it on there, I don't believe it was there. Why? Yeshua said, this is the most important of all the mitzvot. And if the Nazarenes heard Yeshua say that, what do you think they thought? I think it was so prominent that it influenced the way that the sages wrote the Mishnah. Now, second thing, that Judaism could offer a set of beliefs that one could subscribe to no matter how, when, or where one lived. It was called
Torah. Commandments.
Exactly. You can understand that. It doesn't matter where we go. We got the Torah. And see, this was one thing that all of the Gentiles didn't have. They didn't have a book. And I will conclude with this. This set of beliefs were perceived to be what is called techne, which is, sounds like what? Technical? That's what it is. Technical knowledge. Okay? Technical da'at. Okay? So it would be technical knowledge. So it would be someone who had studied the book and come away with the knowledge. And it's not that he has, quote, faith in this. It's because it's absolute belief. He knows that this is absolutely the truth. No question. And it's so important to him that it's wedged inside of his consciousness to the place that you couldn't take it out. Have I made my point clear?
There's
none. Questions or comments? None?
It's like the comment at work the other day. Isn't Jesus wonderful? Does so much for us. I wanted to bang my head in for. But I made no comment because I didn't know how to respond to that because it would have just caused.
Well, it's a true statement, but the problem is it's a confused idea of that, you know, there's just what? We can resign ourselves from any activity because he's so wonderful, we don't have to worry about anything.
I told her what to say.
Yeah, I told her.
But I'm careful with how I tell her. Suggested a possibility that I would have said, well, he certainly knows how to pray.
Absolutely.
Intercession. Who's he making intercession to?
Two. Oh, there's only one. Questions or comments? Did we lose everybody?
Yeah.